A matter of security. That's the key word today. I want to pick up where I left off on an interesting flight with a man that I think could have easily been a terrorist. But the story ended well because we arrived. But another story began when we were picking up our baggage in Seattle at the baggage collection center. Remember, I had had a conversation that no one else remembered or no one else knew. But everybody had been on that plane with a scandal, with an apparent bomb going off, with the screaming and then yelling. And then as we picked up our bags, people began talking about it. And what I could not believe was how quickly people identified the enemy. I thought they would say, you know, we have to be careful of Islamic fundamentalists, that fanatical element, let's say, of a religion of peace. What they said very quickly, four of them as I remember, they said particularly, the enemy is made up of religious fanatics. And they said especially and including Christian fanatics. Where that came from I don't know, but I have heard it since. And there's no question that since 9/11, in a world, in a country certainly, that in spite of all of the church attendance, all of the religious political activity, is of a secular mindset. Certainly the divine, the spiritual, the power of God is not recognized. And for many of those people, religion, yes, is their security. But freelance religion, people with their eyes wide open with enthusiasm, people that go, as Ellen White says, door to door, their faces lighted up, these are the enemy. These are a threat because they're not encased in the wagons of secure religious institutions. In case I had any doubt about it, a few days after that I read an article in the World magazine, I think it was, that commented on what Rudolph Giuliani had said immediately following 9/11. And I heard him say this. He spoke before the United Nations and he said, I've just come from worshipping at a synagogue, or praying at a synagogue. I've just come from praying at a cathedral. I've just come from praying at a mosque. And he says, and I know we are getting through to God. And the writer of the article in World magazine, which is actually a fairly right-wing conservative Protestant magazine, but on this occasion he got it right. He said, this is a syncretistic response to religion that troubles me. He said that they've gathered together all of these safe religious belief systems for security. They are the norm. And he said, but I don't worship the God of some of those groups that he quoted. And a little bit later than that, we had a meeting of the Washington Washington group that's of church and religious liberty groups, and it was headed up by Ambassador Seipel. He's a Baptist a minister, I think, or he used to be. In fact, I think he's changed his religion, but he was a Baptist, and he had been the first ever United States Ambassador for Religious Freedom, as well as before that he'd been head of World Vision, I think it was. And I told him what I had noticed, both the reaction from this flight and then the comment in World magazine, and I said, the freelance religious activity is now suspect. And he agreed with me, and I've heard him on any number of occasions since, speaking about the need for churches and the state to be co-guarantors of security. And I'm sorry that I gave him, or at least started him on that track, because that's not the conclusion that I want. That's the description that I make of what's happening, but that's a horrible conclusion. And as I think I alluded to a few sessions ago, that's precisely what happened in the worst days of the Soviet dictatorships throughout the Soviet Union, where religious organizations were subverted and co-opted to work together with the state to keep their members under the control, and they were made complacent. And now the stakes seem so much higher because the very survival of our society, as they often say, you know, our freedom is at stake. There's a certain irony in the fact that to save our freedom, we'll give away any freedom necessary. There's not enough time to talk about that. But in that context, it's very obvious that freelance religionists are not controlled by any responsible organization. You don't know what they do. Religion, by definition, is something beyond the rational. So these irrational people who believe something that we can't even understand, they could be the same type that will, you know, bring buildings down in skyscrapers in New York, or blow up a clinic, perhaps an abortion clinic, or who knows, or a hole up in a building in Waco, Texas. You never know. I was very interested recently. Someone sent me an article from the Foreign Affairs Journal. And there was an article there about Al-Qaeda and how it's reformulating and how it recruits worldwide. It was nothing but an article about Al-Qaeda in the context of the Middle East. And two-thirds of the way through, it mentioned there that Al-Qaeda has even managed to recruit a certain Islamic reform organization. And they say, you know, this organization has never shown a proclivity to violence. But they said, even here, they are recruiting. And then it made the comment, it says, even though many people have said that this subset of Islam, I wish I could remember the subset, they said, even though many people have said it is no more prone to violence than a Seventh-day Adventist. Why were we dropped in there? All I can figure is it's connected to Waco, which we are not as connected as we're not really connected, but sociologically we are, and it's derivative. They were derivative of some of the things that we hold. I believe the lines have been drawn. Even before 9/11, did you know that the FBI, preparing for the millennium, had a plan of attack, or a preemptive plan to stop troubles, and it was called Project Megiddo. And part of the profile of troublemakers was anybody that believed in the return of Jesus Christ, the literal return of Jesus Christ. It has already become a sort of code for someone that wants an apocalyptic solution. These are interesting, interesting times. In Revelation 6, verses 9 and 10, you know, it's very figurative. It says, the souls under the altar in heaven, they cry out, how long, O Lord, before you will avenge the blood of the martyrs and so on? How long? And they're told to wait a little longer. But, you know, we wonder, what can happen next? What do we have to go through before everything's resolved in the sweetness and light of heaven? Revelation 14, that's central to Seventh-day Adventists, of course it says, after announcing the message of the angels, it says, here is a call for the endurance of the saints. Here is a call for the steadfastness. You've got to stay the course. Don't be frightened. Even though I'm saying it in a way to catch your attention, but we can't afford to be scared out of our way, because by speaking of what we believe, we'll be lumped in with the seditious elements in society. We're not seditious, but perception is half the game anymore, or the accusation. You know, tips is our modern form of what I said I saw in Bulgaria with the secret police walking around. With tips, who knows what your neighbor will say if you come to their door, your face lighted up with enthusiasm about the excitement of the times and the fact that the Lord is to come. That might be, for someone, proof positive that you're somebody who will upset society. These men are turning the world upside down, it was said. Going back to the English Civil War and the religious rule that followed, and it had high motives. You know, they hardly did everything right, but there was an interesting presentation that was given toward the end of Oliver Cromwell's rule. His chaplain and close friend gave a sermon to the opening of Parliament in 1656. And it was only 7 years since they'd executed the king, which affronted Europe. It was before the French Revolution. It was certainly the first time in the formal history, I think, of Europe where the people had judicially executed their king. You know, divine right of kings and all that. This was like attacking gods in the minds of other countries. But he spoke to them at the end of the rule, basically. And it certainly can be applied to where we are as a people, I think, today. In these times, troublous times, their world was collapsing even as he spoke. They were about to invite the king back, bring back the persecuting power. He says, take heed that there arise not a generation that knew us not in the days of our distress, contending with those who would have destroyed us, who were not engaged with us in praying, fasting, fighting in England, Scotland and Ireland, but were unconcerned in all our affairs, who knew nothing of the cries, tremblings and fears wherewith this cause has been managed. Can we expect that they should be acted by the spirit of it? What know they of the communion we have had with God in this business all along? The whole business is to them a story of that which is past, wherein they are not concerned. I can't think of a better testimony of what's happening to our people right now. You know, the world is swirling around, as William Butler Yeats in his poem The Second Coming said, that, you know, the things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Anarchy is loosed upon the world, the blood-dimmed tide is loose, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. That's a pretty good description of what's happening around us. And perversely, in our own midst, there has arisen a generation that know nothing of it. I've spoken to quite high up leaders in our church about it, and unfortunately they agree that we're not into hypocrisy. I wish there was something that benign. Hypocrisy you can deal with, because hypocrisy is you know something and you live something else. What we are into is a shift in thinking, and the new generation has arisen that knows nothing of what Protestantism is, knows nothing of what the church claims to be, knows nothing of what we expect to pass in this world, hopes for the best, thinks well of itself, and will compromise as necessary in an expedient way to make its way in the world and among other religionists. It's not an indictment necessarily of our new generation or of the church, it's the spirit of the times. I have a wonderful lecture, among many lectures that I'm collecting in my office. Cliff Goldstein got me in the habit of it, from the teaching company. There's a wonderful lecture there by a sociology professor that he explains that is the spirit of this new generation. They are enablers. They want to satisfy the situation they're in. And he says, you know, they can come to me in my class, and he said they can present as an upright, moral person, and that night they can be partying, you know, to a level you couldn't have imagined. Then they can go somewhere else and they fit that mold, and they don't see it as any distinction. They are what the market bears. And this new generation have not been conditioned for moral absolutes. They have not been conditioned for clear-cut goals in life. It's expediency, it's moral relativism, all of the things that break down the commitment that is so enjoined upon a group like the Remnant Church, with a charge to proclaim the three angels' messages and the expectation of the Lord's return to a ready, prepared people. C.S. Lewis, in a quote that impressed me a lot when I read it, it was written in the 50s, maybe it impressed me because it's back, I can just remember the 50s, unfortunately. He says, the doctrine of the second coming is deeply uncongenial to the whole evolutionary or developmental character of modern thought. We have been taught to think of the world as something that grows slowly toward perfection, something that progresses or evolves. And that thought still lingers, just because we got a quagmire, supposedly by some people's definition, in Baghdad, doesn't mean that society is not gripped by the idea of onward and upward, and that we're perfecting. You know, even Supreme Court Justice Scalia, in a lecture that I've got, mocking his fellow justices for their Pollyanna-ish view of the Constitution, he says, you know, he quoted from Voltaire, he says, you know, they think it's every day I'm better in every way. That's sort of a superficial view of a lot of people about society. And I must admit, as someone who likes electronics, you can come to that. You know, the gadget this year is far surpassed by the one that comes next year at half the price. You know, the gasoline may go up, but next year's car is going to be so much better. Next year's president, we hope, is better. You know, those sort of things. I mean, they fall down when you put that sort of construct on it. But we think, as Francis Fukuyama, who is in the inner circle of this present administration, so famously said, analyzing societal developments, he said, we've reached the end of history. Everything had developed upward toward a certain perfection of cultural and societal development. Well, it's not static, so it must be going back, but we always want to see it going somewhere positive. But he continues, he says, Christian apocalyptic offers us no such hope. It does not even foretell which would be more tolerable to our habits of thought, a gradual decay. It foretells a sudden, violent end imposed from without. An extinguisher popped under the candle. A brick flung at the gramophone. This sort of dates the statement. A curtain rung down on the play. Halt! And I think Seventh-day Adventists need to get back to that understanding. You know, he says there'll be delay no longer. Cut it short in righteousness. It's not going to swirl around in a mishmash forever. And I am absolutely convinced the missing element is revival. Once that revival comes, it's over. In quick succession, these things will race on to their fulfillment. I missed it earlier, but I would be negligent not to go back and remind you of a story that's in Acts chapter 4. But maybe as a prelude to that, let me just read you. Well, I'll have it for reference, but I'll tell you because I observed some of this. There's an article that appeared in New Republic, I think it was, where they quoted two of our present leaders saying interesting things. But one of them I heard in Colorado Springs. I heard General Eberhardt, newly appointed commander of the Northern Command. I'd never heard it before. Northern Command is the homeland. All of the forces, Army, Navy, Air Force, National Guard, Coast Guard, you name it. Everything under one centralized command. They're ready to fight terrorists here at home. And he was about as close to me as this woman here, and I'm looking up rather incredulously as he was talking. Seemed a very nice fellow, but where I looked incredulous was he said, after explaining they're ready to go there, do this. He didn't use the word bomb, but, you know, implicit his tanks will go in and so on. And then he said, you know, some people have concerns about the Posse Comitatus Act, but he says, we don't see a problem there in light of recent changes in the law. What those recent changes would be escapes me, unless there's some sort of free pass under the Patriot Act, because it's forbidden under the Constitution. This article quoted him, so they must have heard it too. He says here, we must start thinking differently, alluding to citizens not focusing on the home game. Terrorism would activate their military operations. And he says, so despite the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, Americans might find their streets patrolled by combat troops. And then it followed on and says, in a recent interview, now retired General Tommy Franks, who led the U.S. military invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, told the men's lifestyle magazine Cigar Aficionado in December that if the United States is hit with a weapon of mass destruction that inflicts large casualties, the Constitution will likely be discarded in favor of a military form of government. Now, he's not the one to do it or say it, but he's certainly someone in an inner circle enough to know the thinking. That should be a wake-up call for people. You know, if we have such an event, it's not an if, it's when. Satan has been plotting and planning. Ellen White says things like he's been manipulating the weather. He's certainly manipulating people's inclinations. We know that there are groups that would gladly bring down every Tower of Babel they could find. How are we to respond? These are, in essence, threats against our freedom of activity as Christians and even on a civil level as citizens. In Acts chapter 3 and 4, there's a story that really must link to the way I started early today. A few hours ago now, Jesus spoke to his disciples, told them plainly what was to come. And it's amazing to follow the development, if you can use such a word, of those disciples through the period when Jesus was teaching them. You know, Peter, enthusiastic. I'm surprised the Catholics want to own him so easily because, you know, he was called "Get behind me, Satan" at one point. He really didn't quite understand things as he should have, like the others, until after Pentecost. James and John, they wanted to be seated at the right hand of God. They wanted to be kings and rulers. And, you know, another time they wanted to call down the fire of heaven on a city that rejected Christ. They were pretty bad pupils, even though Jesus spoke directly to them. But after Pentecost, they started acting differently. And it's It's sort of self-evident that the world for them had become immeasurably more dangerous after Christ's resurrection. And here in Acts chapter 3, Peter and John come back to the temple, which in reality was the scene of the last confrontation. It's true they took Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, but the precipitation of those final events was his last appearance there in the temple. And so they return to the scene of the crime, if you like. And here this lame man asks for money, and they give him healing, and there's a furor, and people gather around as they will, and certainly in traditional lifestyle parts of the world like that. I remember in India, giving a few cents to someone and nearly being crushed by the literally thousands of beggars that will come around. I'm sure this was a scene that immediately was a public scandal, if you like, or near riot. And they said to them, "Men of Israel, why do you marvel at this or look so intently at us as though by our own power or godliness we had made this man walk?" And then the temple authorities came, and it says they laid hands on them, arrested them, and they wanted to know, "Why are you doing this? What authority do you have? What authority?" And as I read those words there, I think of Jesus, where he, in the Sermon on the Mount, five chapters Jesus divulged himself of the principles of the kingdom. I mean, we're inclined to rise to the bait of people that talk about the Ten Commandments and whether or not they're binding. You don't have to go there you can go directly to Jesus. He affirmed the commandments and he particularized the principles of the kingdom. And it says the people heard him gladly because he spoke with authority. And it's interesting that now the followers of Jesus, they say, "By what authority do you say these things? By what power or by what name have you done this?" And you know the text that I have to refer to. Verse 13, it says, "Now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived that they were uneducated and untrained men, they marveled and they realized that they had been with Jesus." And I've heard plenty of people preach about that, but they seldom bring out the reality that they were not changed. They were still uneducated, common men. I have to remember in Australia, I went to a New Year's Eve proms party, I think it was, in Australia, where they had actors dressed up as the King and the Queen, Queen Victoria. And at one stage she waved at them with the twirly wave and she says, "As I look out at you, my people, I see that you are indeed common, very common." Well, you know, we can all feel a little bit put down when someone says that, but as far as looking at Christ and the sophistication that you might think that we would need to project him, thanks to God, it's not needed. These were unsophisticated men. It sounds good. Fishermen. What you really mean is a subsistence aquaculture individual. They were not wealthy men. I've seen some imaginative work done that these were wealthy small businessmen. Nonsense. They had to fuss around to get the tax to pay when the government asked it, to get it out of a fish. There wasn't much money around. They were poor, common, uneducated. But there had been a change, not of them, but that was visible through them. They perceived that they had been with Jesus. And it says in verse 18, they called them and they commanded them not to speak at all nor to teach in the name of Jesus. What if people told us that? Shut up about, the Revelation 13, shut up about preparing people for Jesus' coming. I'm remembering now that I really intended to tell you about Ambon. That's implicit in what we found in Ambon. I'll tell you that in a moment. It says, "So when they had further threatened them, they let them go, finding no way of punishing them." And what I really share this for is not so much to expand on, the wonderful power that they now showed and the boldness and all this. It's all true. But what happened after they were set free, under threat of death? Basically they were told, "Keep quiet or we'll do to you as we did to Jesus." I don't think that's any enlargement of the meaning of what was given there. They went back to the believers and they prayed to God. It says they gave a report and then they prayed to God and they basically, with him, told him the same thing. In verse 29, this is the conclusion of the prayer. "Now, Lord, look upon their threats
Now, I've been in a few prayers in the Adventist church over the years, starting when I was preteen. I can remember praying fervently in our church that our people in Colombia would be able to operate freely, that they were suffering some persecutions when I was younger. You know, we used to pray for the people in Russia. Goodness knows they were in trouble. Let me tell you, they're in as much trouble now. The Eastern Orthodox are every bit as vicious against people as the communists were, but we tend not to see it as a greater threat. But, you know, we pray for relief. We pray for healing. And not all of the prayers are answered, but here's a prayer. What did they pray for? Look upon their threats and grant to your servants that with all boldness they may speak your word. You can go through this whole chapter. There's nothing there about being protected. Nothing. Grant to your servants that with all boldness they may speak your word by stretching out your hand to heal, and that signs and wonders may be done through the name of your holy servant Jesus. And, you know, we can try to figure out which prayers God will answer or which he won't. And goodness knows, most of our lives, the more personal it gets, we're more perplexed because we don't see clearly what God would want for our life. But there's really no mystery about the type of prayer that God answers. When God's own integrity is on the line and we are praying for power to advance his cause, he answers. And it says in the next verse, verse 31, and when they had prayed, the place where they were assembled was shaken, and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit, and they spoke the word of God with boldness. The answer was given immediately. At the end of last year, Dr. John Gratz and I traveled a long way, going to two very interesting and distant places, distant from here and distant from each other. The first was Laos, which is a little country just off to the side of Vietnam and tucked up underneath China, a country that people at least my age well remember as being sucked in and into the Vietnam War and bombed relentlessly by the United States. More munitions dropped on Laos than on Europe during World War II. That'll give you an idea of what's dropped there. Well, you wouldn't know it nowadays. The visible scars have gone. And then we traveled on from Laos quite a few hours down to Jakarta, Indonesia, and then 4.5 hours by air across the nation of Indonesia to its other periphery in the Moluccas, to the provincial capital of Ambon. These are two very interesting case studies of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, certainly, but let's just say all Christian churches and how they relate to stressful situations. Laos is today a doctrinaire Catholic, a doctrinaire communist state, revolutionary state, if you like. The communist insurgents that the U.S. was fighting took over in the mid-70s and have ruled it ever since. When they first took over, we had a church there, and one of the officials came in the front door and met one of the elders who lived in the church, and he said, "I've come to take the church. The state now owns everything." And the elder said, "No, you can't have it. This is my home. I don't have any authority to give it to you." And they got into an argument, and the official said, "Well, I'll be back tomorrow, and we will take it." And he never came back because he died that night. A few years later, a deputation came, and they said, again, "We've come to take it. It's going to be a youth hall." And a similar argument broke out. The elder said that it was his home. He wasn't going to give it up, and they argued, and he said, "We'll be back. We will do as we said," and they never came back. So there were some clear signs in the past of faithfulness and of God clearly protecting that church. But as we visited in this day and age, while it's far from me to make any judgment about the inner heart of any particular individual, we could see a very dangerous dynamic that has developed with our members there. Small church, about half, maybe even less, the size of this church. And we met with them on Sabbath after having met with the Catholic leaders and evangelical Protestants and government leaders and the U.S. ambassador and a number of officials. It was all very educational. But when we met with our members, they seemed very untroubled. They met freely in the church, pretty much like here, same songs. I'm sure it wasn't in English always, but for our benefit, most of it was in English. And or translated, and so it seemed very familiar. No stories of persecution that we could hear, even though it's really forbidden to advance religion other than Buddhism. Christianity is forbidden to advance Christianity in that country, and Christianity in particular, Protestantism in particular, has a problem in that country, because when the United States was involved, we used the Hmong tribesmen up in the north, I think it is, as proxies to fight against the communists, and we used them because they are largely, or at least significantly, of a Christian affiliation, and they have separatist inclinations. So today, when you spread Christianity, it almost carries the subtext that you are promoting a separatist movement within the country. So it doesn't go over very well, not to mention the fact that communism is ideologically opposed to Christianity. We met with the Protestants, as I said. They call themselves an evangelical church, but they're not connected to evangelicals here. It was just an independent Bible-believing group. Very vigorous worship service, a lot of activity, a lot of young people. We met with them and found out that, yes, they have had many people imprisoned. They've had 50, 60 people imprisoned in the last few years, usually just for giving out literature. That's all it takes. You go up into one of the villages out of the capital of Vientiane with Christian literature, and if you give it to the wrong person, and they report you to the village chieftain and say that you're a seditionist, that you're advancing separatist views, bam, you're in prison, and typically 15 to 25 years. Thankfully, Ambassador Seipel was able to release a few people on one of his visits, but many of them still languish in jail. But there are no Seventh-day Adventists in jail. I found that sort of funny. But when we talk to them, we find, yes, they're free to come and go, they have businesses and that. Never found any evidence that they were going out giving out literature. They're very happy to meet within their environment. They have a very competent leader who knows the communist leadership, and in fact he told me, he says, they are my brothers and sisters. He went to school with them. So he's able to intercede, but I think he's also able, as often the case, to encourage or discourage activity. And so we talked to some of the members, and we found that, yes, they were not harassed, there was no imprisonment, but there seemed to be a problem with creeping Buddhism. They would have a Christian Adventist wedding or funeral or other service in the church. They would go back to their neighborhood and have a Buddhist ceremony and so on. So it was mingling, because they had no sense of separateness or of mission. And we very quickly deduced that here, in a hostile environment, there's no question where the state would hedge them around. And even when we went there, they'd drawn up a decree number 7, I think it was, that listed in pidgin English, basically, how, you know, type of the language it would use is, people of religion must not use any malicious tricks and so on to interfere with government. You know, nonsense sort of talk. But the government clearly have an inclination, because of external pressure, to allow or regulate in some way religious activity. So they're not absolutely prohibiting it. But here in our church, where they're hedged about with this, where there's a sense of external oppression but no local pressure, as long as you come to church, sit in these pews, socialize with your fellow members, or with anyone else, never mention religion, not the slightest problem. And what are you to make of that? That could easily happen here. What you know? What if we start to see some incipient Sunday-type laws? What if we start to see strong regulations on in-gathering? You know, usually religious persecution presents in subtle ways. It could be zoning regulations, it could be tax laws and so on. It doesn't always, in fact, rarely hits you between the eyes as, because of your religion, we don't want you to do this. Are you going to let negatively developed laws, perhaps with an agenda behind them, hedge your way? Do they determine your parameters? After Laos, we went down to Ambon, and this is a whole different situation. 3 years ago now, in fact, immediately after September 11, I remember hearing the details, because John Gratz and I went to a hearing in Washington, a Senate hearing on the Ambon and Vietnamese situation, and we heard there that Al-Qaeda operatives were suspected of moving down to the Ambon area and fomenting religious violence. And we heard a wonderful old grandfatherly type from the community, a Muslim leader. Got a lot of sympathy from everybody by saying how, you know, this was against the character of the community, and you must understand we're all a people of peace and so on. People were quite sympathetic until he said, you must understand, he said, we had none of this problem before the Christians came. And I distinctly remember Elliot Abrams, the chairman, rolling his eyes when he heard that. So we were interested to go down and see what had happened, because when Al-Qaeda representatives went down there, and they did foment, there were 500 or 600 outside operatives went down, and very quickly, on some little pretext, the fight between a Christian taxi driver and a Muslim passenger, violence broke out. And as we investigated with our members there in Ambon, we found that in spite of what we thought, we might not have gone otherwise, because it was still under a, not quite a state of emergency, but forbidden for outside tourists or journalists. And we were the first, probably some of the first Westerners, because there was, we never saw anybody else other than the locals there. From when we went until nearly 3 years prior, they had just running warfare between Christians and Muslims. And it had started on that flashpoint on that day in the middle of the city of 300,000 people. We thought, when we'd even seen videos of it, that it was out in some village context, because we'd seen videos, you know, worse than the prisons in Iraq. We'd seen videos of people being sliced into pieces with machetes. We'd seen people being run through, of piles of bodies being pushed into valleys, sort of like Auschwitz. Horrendous stuff. We'd seen pictures of bottles, hundreds of bottles being filled with gasoline by we thought, village women, wicks put in them, and then passing them out to toughs who were fanning out down the street, and the camera shifted, and you could see them firebombing the houses. This was all happening downtown, and the Adventists told us that, yes, thousands of Christians and Muslims faced off. The Christians were singing and yelling out, everybody ought to know who Jesus is. The Muslims were yelling out, Allah Akbar, which, interestingly enough, in Indonesia, as in many countries of the world, even in our Adventist hymn books, when you sing about God, it's Allah, same word. Maybe a lot more covered, depending on who you are, but same word. And then they surged together in an orgy of killing and fighting and stabbing, and the Christians, some Adventists even, bragged to us that they send, that one of their secret weapons was a little preteen kids. They called them agats or gnats. And they would send them out into the Muslim areas to firebomb and run between legs and that, and just throw incendiary devices in the homes. And as we drove from the airport, probably 20 miles around the bay to the center of town, probably 20 to 25% of all public structures burned and abandoned. Mosques, churches, state university, homes abandoned, people killed. A scene of horror where the police, Christian police, had been fighting the Muslim military. And a week or two ago, when it broke out again, I heard on the news the police chief had been replaced. So I knew Christian police chief gone, military in again, 40 people killed, it's the same thing. And as we talked to our Adventist believers, there were very good tales of faithfulness. But there was a general pattern that troubled us again. Too many of them had been sucked up in the paranoia of the moment. Too many of them had picked up their guns and gone out and joined the killing. There was even a scene where an elder had asked for the pastor to come and have a service, blessing his gun and his bullets as he went out to shoot Muslims. And it seems, I hope it seems bizarre to explain that, but it's not such a big step from what we're moving into. Goodness knows I can give you plenty of doctrinal reasons that we should be fearful of the militant Islamic belief. But as far as the right of a Muslim or of a Hindu or whatever to believe it, in this country, as long as there's a constitution, we need to be prepared to die to maintain their right to believe it. Not to do what they were doing in Ambon. Once the violence erupts, you go to religious and tribal lines and forget it. You shoot the enemy. That's what happened to us in Rwanda. 10% of that country were Adventists. There's a fellow in jail right now, one of our leaders, because he assembled people in a church for killing, saying it was God's will. We dare not fall into that model. And yet it happened so easily in Ambon. We saw it. And in fact, I even spoke to an elder and asked him about one of the elders, the likelihood of violence. "Oh, we're ready," he said. "I've got my guns. We're ready." And perhaps the epitome of degradation that such a situation can drag people down. There was one Adventist young man who had had his family member, his parents and two siblings killed. I don't believe they were Adventists. And he vowed to kill 8 Muslims, which he did. And then he came in a religious meeting crying and trembling and begged forgiveness and asked to be rebaptized and admitted that he had cut their hearts out and eaten them raw. There's no level, there's no depth that hatred of a religious nature won't take someone. And we saw a church, not wholesale, but there was a clear pattern where they were swept up in the paranoia. And total societal breakdown is predicted not just for Ambon, it's predicted in some places for here. Are we going to be joined the vigilantes? Think that will save us? I must tell you redeem a part of the story there. On 3 occasions, Muslim gangs came against our compound in Ambon. On 3 occasions, they came against the compound. The first time, they were, and we know this from the Muslims, so this is not a story from the Adventists. On the first occasion, they saw an unearthly light in the half-finished church building that really spooked them, so they ran. The second time, they came back to our compound, which is largely bordered by jungle, no fence whatsoever, and there's a little fieldstone marker or line across the front, maybe this high, and a gate. I'm not even sure there's a gate. But they came at night the second time, and in the dark, they knew it pretty well, they lived nearby, they came up against a wall, and someone got on someone else's shoulders, and they couldn't get over it, it was too high for that. So they felt around in the darkness for the gate. And they went all the way around the property. No gate. So they went into town and told that story. It's hardly something that our people could have manufactured themselves. The third time they came back. And this time there was no fence, but they were totally disconcerted to see there guarding the property a band of soldiers dressed in white uniforms. And what was remarkable, and the Muslim gang leaders particularly told this around the community, was that the leader of this group was seated on a large horse. And what was really significant was how he was sitting there. Rather than on a saddle, it was like he had a sort of a throne on top of the horse. We have to say it as we hear it, and God has revealed himself in those ways. Even if, in the most cynical moments, you dismiss it as non-divine origin, It's most significant that in a conflict to the death between religious factions, that these Muslim toughs, you can put no other name to it, these killers, they were there to kill, would spread such a story of respect and of divine power that was protecting those people. So good things happened. But it's hard to find the good among so many burned and ruined homes. It's hard to see it as a positive outcome when the bullet holes are all through the walls of the church. The woodwork up the front splintered by bullets, then to be told that the snipers would stand up the back and shoot across. It's hard to even be easy, as we did when we visited the deputy mayor up in a Muslim enclave, and he welcomed us and said we were the first outsiders to visit since the violence. And he said, "Do you realize," he says, "no Christian would dare come here. They'd be killed on the spot." That's just a level of antagonism between a communities that we've not yet seen, but it's happened there. Adventists are in the middle of it, and how do they relate to it? Thankfully, some of them sheltered Muslims. Thankfully, some of them have kept to their posts. Others fled. There was a medical team that have fled. They've never come back. Does that mean that when violence breaks out, as we move into a cataclysm that will end only with the Lord's second coming, that we only have medical missionaries where it's safe? Does that mean that if someone says, "Here's the belt, you know, you go to this place, you'll be bound up or imprisoned or killed. Don't go." Are we going to be like Paul and say, "No, I'll go anyhow," or maybe say, "No, I'll run away till the peace treaty is settled"? This is the sort of decision that I think wasn't always made accurately in Ambon, and it's a lesson for us. And to reiterate, 2 models. Troubling in both regards, even as we found wonderful individuals, that we could empathize with and see God's Spirit was in them. But the two communities, one allowing the state to make their barrier, to determine their activities, to limit their witness, and in essence making them as ineffectual as if they'd been locked in a prison. And the other, in a swirling, violent situation that is still continuing, and according to Lashkar Jihad on their website that I read when I came back, they said that we have declared war. They said this will be another Afghanistan. Let the US come down with their helicopters and gunships. We're going to fight to the finish. Doesn't sound like a situation that will ease off anytime soon. What are you going to do in that situation? Do you take up arms, or you decide that there is no just war except the war of the Spirit, and that we're preparing for Armageddon, which to this day I believe our church does believe is ultimately a spiritual battle, even as the world defines it in its own self-serving ways. We've got to prepare for how we relate to these final crises. In conclusion, I think I'm getting close. We've got a few more minutes. In conclusion, I want to share with you something that came to my mind very shortly. In fact, on September 11, I remember that morning I was sitting in my office. Didn't have my TV on. I've got I've got cable TV in my office where I can watch news reports and so on. Didn't have it on, and Cliff Goldstein came bouncing into my office, and I'll put this on a tape and let Cliff hear this. My children like Winnie the Pooh stories, and Tigger always bounces, and I must tell you that Clifford Goldstein always bounces. And he came in that morning bouncing in, and he said, "Turn on your television." He said, there's a plane has flown into one of the Twin Towers. So I turned it on, and of course we saw repeats of it. And while we were watching, we saw live the second plane come in. And we've all got our stories, I'm sure, of that day. Just like, you know, I'm old enough to remember the day Kennedy died. I can remember exactly where I was. 9/11, it's etched into my memory. What also stuck with me was how quickly on the email and internet communication there at the GC, how quickly people started to swap quotes from Ellen White of situations and letters and testimonies or whatever she'd written that seemed to apply to this situation. And I must admit, I found most of them way off mark, way off mark. A lot of them were where she'd stated it was New York and there were fires that you couldn't put out and so on. But I remembered a quotation that I had read many years before, and it stuck in my mind because I was convinced that it was an erroneous statement, not an error of Ellen White, but an error of printing. So I dug it up again, and I was convinced that it was valid. So I shared it with a few people, and then decided to check with the White Estate. So I checked with Tim Poirier, and at first he said, "That's how it is, you know, that's how it's printed." And I said, "Check the original manuscript." So I went back to Ellen White's handwritten journals where this was originally came from. This is the first sentence. It's from Manuscript Releases, Volume 11. Not sure of the page, but it's manuscript release number 918. And I'm sure you've read parts of it because it's under the heading of Cities Destroyed by Balls of Fire. But she says, "In the night I thought, in a room, but not in my own house. I was in a city where I knew not." That's why most people didn't pick up on this, because it leads you away from New York. She says specifically she doesn't know where it is. It's not in her house, another city, but she doesn't know where it is. She says, "And I heard expression after expression, period. Something missing." I always thought it was something missing, but it could also be the wrong word. So what we found out is Ellen White actually had written, Tim came back after looking at it, said, "You're right." He says she wrote explosion after explosion. So read it again and see if it fits. She says, "And I heard explosion after explosion, period. I rose up quickly in bed and saw from my window large balls of fire." At least two explosions and at least two balls of fire. "Jetting out were sparks in the form of arrows." I remember those explosions as the planes hit. "And buildings were being consumed. And in a very few minutes, the entire block of buildings was falling. And the screeching and mournful groans came distinctly to my ears." Every particular of that is exactly what happened. I'm not going to be foolish enough to tell you that has to be that event, but it is not in conflict with, in any of its details, what happened on that day. And then I like it because of what follows next. She says, "I cried out,
in my raised position to learn what was happening. Where am I? And where are my family, are our family circle? Then I awoke, but I could not tell where I was, for I was in another place than home. I said, O Lord, where am I and what shall I do? It was a voice that spoke, Be not afraid, nothing shall harm you. To me, that's the message that we need to take from not just 9/11, but from the whole matrix of threat or fulfilled prophecy that's in front of us, in my view. I don't think it's possible as a human being to expel fear or at least apprehension as a reaction to some of these things. That's natural. But the fear that paralyzes, the fear that prohibits action, we can deal with that. We can call God's help to inspire us and to impel us to maintain our commitment to proclaiming. And we need to take this promise. Be not afraid. Nothing shall harm you. Remember what the three worthies said. Yeah, you know, you've threatened us, but God is able to deliver us. He's able to save us from the fire, and He certainly will take us out of your hand. And God may not save us from the building as it falls if we're in there. I'm sure if an Adventist had, I think by some definition there were some Adventists. They went down with it. The laws of cause and effect, as Ellen White says, are not suspended. But God's divine providence is still in action, and He will enable, protect, and deliver us as He has a role for us to play. We have to cling to that. And at the end of the day, if we're about His business, He will see that we're taken care of. Remember, and this is where we've got to watch our words, because to the uninitiated, but that even sounds cultic. To those that are not aware of the Bible, the hope of a future promise sounds amazingly like the 10, 15, 20 virgins that might be promised if you blow yourself up. But a foolish person would purposely throw away their life. It's a gift from God. But who but a short-sighted humanist would think that this is all that there is? You know, even if you deny your faith, what are you getting for this life? Nothing but a few years of progressive decay. It has to be beyond this. And beyond this is where it all matters. And as I read the Bible and Ellen White, it's plain that this is the antechamber to the real action. And this is where we're not only being tested, this is where we're gathering other people to come to that grand wedding chamber, or that wedding feast. There's no question that something is happening now. There's no question that the call is out to us to watch out for the monuments around. I'm going to mix metaphors seemingly, but I'm referring back to the beginning. There's no question that we have to be wary of the monuments erected on the plains of Dura, which was a prophecy perverted and presented in a wrong way, just as Christianity and all of the aims of the Christian nation, which is fine now, can be presented in a way that it's denying of God. Let me tell you one last story. That same day that I attended the celebration, which was preemptive for the Choice Act, because as you probably know, the faith-based initiative never went through the legislative process. Went too slowly for some people, and it's been passed by executive order. It's the law of the land now by executive order. But that same day, I attended the 20th anniversary celebration of the Washington Times newspaper. And you're close to Washington, so some of you may remember, which most people have forgotten, that 20 years ago, this of only two major newspapers in the Washington area was established as a 100% owned paper of the Unification Church and of the Reverend Moon, so-called Reverend. And I got myself invited to this celebration because I wanted to hear the Reverend Moon. I thought, let's hear what this guy has to say. He's made incredible claims. And it was amazing to be present on that occasion to hear the Reverend Moon, after all of the luminaries of the Washington power establishment got up and either sang his praises or the newspaper's praises. There was a recorded message from the president's father saying this was the most honest newspaper in support of the Reverend Moon, and on and on. The president sent one of his top
advisors. Dr. Laura was there. Not that she's powerful, but she's symbolic of the right. Reverend Fauntleroy, one of the leaders of the civil rights movement and a past representative for the District of Columbia and a Baptist minister, prayed over the event and blessed it. I don't know if he knew what was coming, but he should have. And then the Reverend Moon got up and he gripped the lectern. He spoke in English at first, and then wisely after a while he slipped to a translator. But he said, "Are there theologians here?" He says, "You think you have the truth." He says, "You listen to me. I have it." And then he said that the spirit world had told him that it was now America's role to Christianize the world, that it had defeated godless communism, and now the spirit world was with the United States to spread religion to the world. And he says, "This city set on a hill." You know, that was the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Winthrop, used that term, and it's resonated with the Christian right ever since. "A city set on a hill. The second Israel," said Dr. Moon. He says, it's now under divine favor to do this. And in case anyone missed his message, he actually handed out the minutes of a meeting that had taken place in the spirit world a little earlier, where the leaders of the major religions had gotten together. He said, I don't necessarily believe him, but I believe the spirit world is active, and the spirit world leaders, all of these world leaders, have determined now that this is the role of the United States. And this is not the only evidence, but if you ever wanted evidence of the threefold union of Romanism and Spiritism, it was there in Washington, planted right in the center of power. And I didn't see any of those representative government leaders walking out. I didn't read that the president's father had withdrawn his support. None of the same. They loved it. It was wonderful. Triumphal America. We're going to Christianize the world. Every religion and every spirit is with us. What are we going to do in reaction to this sort of stuff? Are we going to sort of say, "Well, it's embarrassment, you know"? Or are we going to say, "This is prophetic"? Are we going to say that this Protestant nation is now dabbling with devils? And the incredible nature of it. One of the transcripts of a committee in the spirit world there, it had Muhammad was the master of ceremonies and Jesus took the opening prayer. That's the mundane level that this stuff's on. And it's easy to dismiss Moon and someone like him as just a fantastical megalomaniac who's got visions of delusional visions. But people follow them. It may be it's all self-induced. It's probable, very likely, since it links to so much else in prophetic development, that these are indeed spirit intimations that have a role for this country. Be not afraid. Nothing shall harm you. We need some security, but we need to know where to look for that security. Remember Jesus in the context of the Tower of Siloam fell down and he was asked about it, and 18 people, it sounds nothing compared to 3,000, but it was probably as big a tragedy in the local area. He was asked whether they were guilty, whether they were sinners. Remember the reaction after 9/11. Billy Graham's daughter said, "God is angry with America and we must get religion back into our government." A prophetic, if wrong, statement. And Jesus said, no, they were not more guilty or more sinners than anyone else. But he says, "But you, unless you repent, you will likewise perish." And then a few verses before that, in what should resonate with Seventh-day Adventists, Jesus said, "Fear not, little flock." Not many people. "Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." Thank you.
You've been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2004, American Cassette Ministries. All rights reserved. For additional cassettes or CDs by this speaker, or for a free catalog of other American Cassette Ministries resources, please contact us as follows. Visit our secure website at www.americancassette.org. Our entire catalog is online, plus thousands of other selections to choose from. We accept Visa, MasterCard, and Discover credit cards. Our email address is info@americancassette.org. To order toll-free in the United States and Canada, dial 800-233-4450. For international orders, dial 717-652-7000. For fax orders, dial 717-652-9050. Or you may simply write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 17108, in the United States of America. Maintaining the integrity of the Three Angels' messages for 29 years, American Cassette Ministries requests your continued prayers and financial support as we strive to provide you with the finest, most powerful spiritual messages available. Our one purpose in ministry? To prepare you and your loved ones to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.